Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is...
Amy Brady, publisher of Orion Magazine.
Dr. Amy. It's also Dr. Amy.
It is Dr. Amy if you want to be fancy.
Yeah, I want to be fancy. This is an Agony Aunt podcast and Agony Uncle podcast. So it's Ask Dr. Amy. No, in all seriousness, I wanted to ask you lots of things, but start off by inquiring if you would share with us what's currently preoccupying, dynamizing, retarding, interesting you.
It's such an interesting time of year to ask me that because I feel like my interests are being pulled in a thousand different directions simultaneously. There is the botanical, because this time of year is when my gardens need the most tending. And that has been taking up a lot of my time and interests. But as a writer, I am also finding myself drawn back in time to the history of maps and cartography. And I'm beginning a new research project on how maps either illuminate or obscure our understanding of our environments.
Wow. Okay. Well, in some ways, those could be connected. In some ways, they could be quite separate. The math research could be relaxation from the gardening or vice versa.
Right.
I can see a bit of your indoor garden because you've got lots of plants that look like they're slowly taking over.
I am being consumed by plants. That's how I want to go.
And the outdoor. What's the story with the garden?
There are perennial native gardens, vegetable gardens, annual gardens. It's a bit of a mix of everything. A friend once told me it looked like a Dr. Seuss book, and I take that as a compliment.
That's fun. And because it's spring in the Northern Hemisphere, as you say, this is the season for the ephemerals to start expressing themselves too, I guess, right?
Yeah, lots of things that will be in bloom for about 10 days and then gone for the year, but worth it.
So this is not the time to go on vacation.
No, I am going to need to travel later this month, which does not come at a great time. But no, I do try to be homeward bound for
Right.
this time of year.
A staycation.
A staycation, exactly.
And tell us about the math project. That sounds very interesting too.
Oh, map project.
Sorry, geography. That's right. You said geography, but then I heard map. So we'll change it, right?
Sure. Well, it's in some ways, if not thematic, at least in process, an extension of my ice book. But the map book, you know, stems from this question of how accurately can either paper maps or even state-of-the-art GPS maps illustrate our world when it is changing so rapidly because of the climate crisis. And in my research, I was startled to learn that the answer is not great, is not very well. We are struggling to keep up with mapping the contours of, you know, of our geography. And I'm fascinated to know why that is, what compels us to do it in the first place, and how does our current situation connect to our long history of writing, drawing, confusing, confounding, wildly inaccurate maps, which seems to have been one of our greatest legacies as a species?
So whence stem these inaccuracies, historically and in the contemporary moment, would you say?
Well, we can go all the way back to the ancient world, you know, when, you know, early astronomers thought that Earth was the center of the universe, you know, and it wasn't until approximately 1,000 years after those first maps that Copernicus came around and inverted the diagram so that the sun was at the center. And that fixed a lot of mathematical problems, but even then, not everything was accounted for because Copernicus maps were so concentric, they were so circular, and none of our planets behave in an entirely circular manner. And that just threw the entire, field into question of how accurate can our maps ever really be? And that continues up through time. You can look through the Middle Ages of early explorers to see, pictures of dragons where we now know the South Pacific is with, because it was unknown. It was unknown world. It was unknown planet.
Terra incognita,
It
right?
was terra incognita. That's exactly right. And then we, arrive at a time today when, if you look at any map of the United States, printed recently, including the official map of the state of Louisiana, and that state still looks like a boot. I remember learning it as the boot state when I was a child, but Louisiana doesn't look like a boot anymore. It's lost almost entire its entire southern coast. It looks like tentacles down there. So what are we doing? Still drawing the map like that. These are all just questions that I'm wrestling with, and I have a long ways to go before I find satisfying answers. Or maybe there aren't answers. Maybe there's just more questions.
There was a play that I went to a decade ago, not very successful, I think, called Drawing the Line. Do you know about this play?
I
It might
don't.
interest you. It is about the debates that went on within the Raj in the mid to late 40s about drawing the line between India and Pakistan. And it's all about geography and about the political and contingent construction of frontiers. And of course, we see huge amounts of that because of the imperial legacy, the difference between Brazil and the rest of Latin America, for example, the distinctions drawn within Africa and Asia, and so on. And so, as you say, there are these environmental changes, there are mistakes, there are otherworldly accounts, and there is also this thing called empire.
No, that's exactly right. And empire not only redraws maps to establish boundaries in its favor, but in environmentally speaking, it is also a detriment by saying this is this type of land and this type of climate. This is forest. And we have an empiric or an empirical notion of what forest is. This is desert, and thus we, will treat this land as we understand desert. But when you look at maps based on, say, indigenous traditional knowledge, suddenly those climates and those microclimates look much differently, and the ways in which they should be approached for maintenance and sustainability look much different. I was just reading the other day about firefighters in Oregon that have adapted indigenous maps for firefighting. And now some of those wildfires that burn year round, which used to only burn, for certain times of year, but because of the climate crisis now burn year round, they're managing them much better with these new maps. So yeah, it's a wild time to be alive.
And when and how did you get this interest in this new project?
Well, I would say the same way that I got interested in ice and in my ice book, which is, like ice, maps have always been a part of my life. I am of a generation that grew up on paper maps. I still prefer paper maps to GPS because I like the act of figuring it out and of my navigational route. And I like seeing the landscape in its entirety rather than just as a single blue line pointing the way.
Turn right in 50 feet.
That's right. Exactly. Well, I want to see what's in 50 miles. And, like with ice, it's a subject that feels grossly understood and underwritten about in any sort of cultural context. And so, I want to fill that gap to satisfy my own curiosity more than anything.
I'm interested in what happens to two different kinds of upbringing. One where in a heterosexual nuclear family, your parents fight over directions in the car and fight over map reading, and the other where they don't. Does this lead to different stories of violence, addiction, success, love, failure?
Well, maybe a different relationship with maps. One inspires hostility and childhood trauma. The other one, it just inspires memories of a nice, warm family vacation.
Right. So, Prof. Doc Publisher Brady, your book, Ice From Mixed Drinks to Skating Rinks, A Cool History of a Hot Commodity, is a big deal book. And I have a question from my soon-to-be 9-year-old daughter for you, who asked me, please ask Amy whether she likes ice.
That is such a profound question for a 9-year-old, for anybody, because there's not an easy answer to that. I feel like, as perhaps a typical American, I can't live without it. Even in the relatively climate stable New England, it gets pretty darn hot here now in the summertime. And if I'm going to spend any significant time outdoors, I want ice in my drink to help cool me down. I am also physically a reckless person. I am accidentally injuring myself all the time. And so ice is a wonderful antidote to swollen joints. And I would be much more uncomfortable without ice. So on the one hand, I value it and I'm grateful for it. On the other hand, the history of ice in the United States has profoundly changed. This country's psychological understanding of what cool is and should be, and I mean that in the temperature sense. Which has had a lot of impacts, on both, our local environments and the planet. The ice industry led to electric refrigeration, which in turn led to a global cooling industry that now contributes approximately 10% of all carbon emissions worldwide. That is not insignificant. And as the climate crisis continues to accelerate. It's hard not to think about that whenever I fill my glass with ice.
And of course, that also leads to the electrical as well as the electronic part of e-waste, big time.
That's right. That's right. So most Americans have at least one refrigerator. I learned an astonishing fact that tens of millions of Americans have two or more electric refrigerators in their homes. And in the typical American home, the refrigerator draws more energy than any other appliance. And if it has an ice maker, it draws even more energy because those ice makers never shut off. They run constantly. That's why I can get ice at 3 in the morning when my most recent injury is acting up.
What's now tell us about some of these injuries and the use of ice. Where are your favorite spots for hurting yourself and then applying ice or frozen peas, perhaps?
Yeah, or frozen peas work too. I'm a runner, and like so many runners, I ignore my physician's advice on how to run accurately, when and how to do it. So I've injured my knee, my ankle. I'm a gardener. I threw out my lower back and my left shoulder last year. I'm sure I'll do it again this year. There's always something that seems, to be out of whack in ice. Ice helps, and ice has helped people, for millennia. And here in the United States, most recently since the Civil War, when physicians adopted ice as a treatment for fevers and swollen joints, and what we now would identify as heat stroke, they probably wouldn't have called it that back then.
I used to live in what was called the Fridge Mountain. It was a 20 feet tall, massive array of discarded refrigerators in East London, which became the site of the Olympic Games in 2012, and the earth had to be boiled twice after all the refrigerators had been removed in order to make it safe for athletes and competitors. And I moved there after it had fridge mountain had been disassembled. But I know what you mean about being a mad runner. I loved it. I did it for 20 years until I finally destroyed my body. But this may not happen to you. I hope it doesn't.
Well, we'll see. Like I said, I'm a fairly stubborn runner, but ice does go a long way
Goes a
to
long way.
mitigate some of those problems.
So the book is fantastic, and it's not only fantastic for its historical reach, but also for its writing. Your prose style is wonderful. And the same
Thank you.
applies to the introduction you co-authored with the book you edited, and also to your journalistic work. And I wanted to ask you, before we get on to talking in a bit more detail about the book, The Ice Book, do you have stylists that you are influenced by, be they non-fiction or fiction or poetic or dramatic or whatever?
Oh goodness, thank you so much for that question. I do. It probably comes as no surprise to hear that I'm a big nonfiction reader. And my favorite kind of nonfiction are works that get at complex ideas with the most straightforward prose as possible. And I say that as an academic. I spend more than a decade, in graduate school and then in teaching college afterwards. I've read a lot of heady, difficult ideas, and it's very difficult, I think, to turn those heady, complex ideas into prose that folks without formal training in reading difficult academic articles can still enjoy. I think even those of us with that formal training don't necessarily enjoy reading some of those articles. And enjoyment is a big part of what I wanted to do. And so that's a long way of saying that I look to writers who I think can do that type of writing well. Ben Goldfarb is one of my favorite writers right now, an environmental journalist who recently published a book on the ecology of roads, which completely changed how I understand highways and roads and the relationship with wildlife. I also love Mary Roach. She's a brilliant science writer who can make an entire book out of a pretty dark subject like death, for example, and not only make it easy to read, but she's also funny. She's got a great sense of humor, and she knows how to inject humor into those dark subjects without belittling the subject. And that, to me, is one of the greatest talents a writer can have.
So they're two lovely examples. Thank you. I must admit, I don't know their work, but now you've clued me into it. I'll be all the richer. And I think science writing and nature writing, naturalism, naturalists, I should say, offer a great deal in terms of communicating science, communicating knowledge, but also doing it with feeling and passion and so on. So back to the Ice Book. When people move to the United States, the first thing they're puzzled by is the arrival of an enormously cold glass of water at every cafe, restaurant, and diner, which is regarded as a natural born right for all Yankees, for all gringos, that this thing will appear. And on a hot New England summer's day, no doubt it is indeed a source of great, considerable relief. Where does this
Very
come from, this notion of it being a divine right of Americans to receive for free, normally, big controversy when someone tries to charge for it, this sort of object?
Yeah, I love that question. Thank you for asking it. I love it because it illustrates how unique on the world scale this American obsession with ice really is. And And that was a big part of why I wanted to write this book, is because I could not find a satisfactory answer for why, whenever I have been in, say, a Parisian cafe and made the terrible blunder of ordering a glass of water with ice in it, I got to look like something was growing out of my head. And
You're
the
very
answer is
un-Parisian.
very, very un-Parisian. How American of me. But it is a distinctly American trait to just automatically assume somebody wants ice in their beverage. And it has historical origins. The history of the American ice trade began in the early 19th century with this eccentric Bostonian named Frederick Tudor, who wanted to make a killing, a lot of money by selling ice carved out of his lake on his family estate in Boston and shipping that ice to people living in warm climates around the world where ice didn't form naturally or very rarely so. And in order to get people to purchase this strange, cold, wet substance that many of them have never even seen before, he had to launch an outrageous marketing plan that showed that ice was at heart a luxury item, right? That could create delicious drinks and cocktails and ice creams and other icy desserts that also required other very expensive ingredients to make, like milk and sugar. These were not cheap back in the early 19th century. And since that day, ice itself and its role in our society has evolved considerably. Probably the biggest change, of course, was the early 20th century with the rise of electric refrigeration that pushed the old ice box out. But whether you're talking about those first chunks of ice or the first ice boxes or the first refrigerators or even today, those countertop ice makers that put out perfectly clear, perfectly shaped pieces of ice that home bartenders can use in their own cocktails. No matter where you kind of, throw the dart in history, ice like that is always being pitched as a luxury item for Americans to aspire to own. So much so that when we get to the 1950s and the first electric refrigerators are, being manufactured at the mass scale, they were advertised as such that to own one was to be on par with owning a car and a television set. It meant that one had arrived at the American middle
The
class.
class.
Yeah,
And
and oh, go ahead.
sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, and I was just going to say that, to kind of drive that point home, Americans are uniquely susceptible to this type of marketing because this is a nation founded on the principle, some might call it a myth, but it is at least a founding principle of upward class mobility. And that is not the case with most places around the world. We are an ambitious, many of us are ambitious people, whether we understand that ambition is a marketing plan or not.
And one of the great little bits in the book is where you talk about New Orleans bartenders devising the vast array of drinks that we now know so well that could not have happened without the ready availability of ice. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so true. And I have to say, in writing this book, I took multiple cocktail tours of New Orleans, which, by the way, is one of my favorite cities in the United States. It's one of the few cities where you don't actually feel like you're in the United States when you're there. And on these cocktail tours, as wonderful and knowledgeable as the tour guides were, none of them actually made that connection to ice. And I was surprised because what you said is absolutely true. New Orleans became one of the first quote unquote Southern ice cities in the United States. It was one of the first American cities that Frederick Tudor brought his ice to. And in order to convince people in the city to buy the ice, he worked with bartenders first, showing them how ice can radically transform the temperature and texture of their cocktails, and that they could do so with spectacle and a sense of wow. And that was exactly what New Orleans bartenders in the early 20th century were looking for. This was already a city undergoing rapid cultural transformation, with people from around the world bringing their proprietary recipes, for food and drink. And Bourbon Street in particular was becoming, one of the most exciting hotbeds of, of night culture in the country. And so to suddenly be able to serve a cocktail that would literally change the temperature of your mouth when you drank it was one of the most exciting things bartenders had ever seen. And so it was just a matter of time before, and a short matter of time before, those bartenders were creating the Sazerac, the gin fizz, different twists on, whiskey sours, all the drinks that we now associate with New Orleans and American cocktail culture.
One of the figures who pops up is Fidel Castro. Tell us about, and there can't be that many books that casually reference Fidel Castro that have been reviewed in the Wall Street Journal.
I thank you for saying so. I bet that's probably true. Yeah, so one of the first places that Tudor brought his ice to was Havana, Cuba. He wanted to prove that his scheme to sell ice would work before he brought it to the southern United States and territories. And in order to get people in Havana to buy his ice, he employed the same approach that he did in New Orleans. He first went to baristas and cafe owners, showed them how to make cocktails on the rocks, and then he showed them how to make ice cream. And just as cocktails took off in New Orleans, ice cream took off in Cuba. It became practically a national dessert. And in my research, I learned that Fidel Castro, more than a century later, was still absolutely obsessed with this stuff, going as far as to order one of each flavor from Howard Johnson's from Canada when, trade embargoes between Cuba and the United States kind of reduced his supply that he was importing. He absolutely loved this stuff. And his followers loved it. Ice cream for the masses became a revolutionary cry among the revolutionaries.
And one of the great qualities of your book, and I suppose this relates to what you admire in the writing of the science journalists or authors, whatever we should call it, reporters that you mentioned, non-fiction authors, is the ability to synthesize scientific and other forms of formal knowledge, be they historical or be they experimental, and make them legible to a wider audience. When you were doing the book, did you come up against information that was hard for you to process? It was a bit outside what you felt you knew about, in inverted commas. And if so, how did you deal with that?
Yeah, in a couple of areas. One was the science itself. My background is in history and literature. That's what I went to school for. And as much as I admire, well, am grateful for science, but also admire the people who understand it and write about it well, there are many aspects of science that I am not formally trained in. And what I learned in writing this book is that ice is a very unusual substance, despite it being a casual part of so many people's lives and appearing in so many places naturally on the planet. There is still a lot the scientists don't understand about the stuff. And so, in order to write about it accurately and with some clarity, I sought the, advice and feedback from multiple experts in all ranges of scientific study to just say, hey, first off, is what I'm writing accurate? Please let me know. And then, if so, I mean, what? Is there something that else that I can, just do that would not be inaccurate, that would help me to better communicate this, for people who don't understand it necessarily as well as you do as scientists? And scientists, I've learned, are wonderful communicators. They really are. And they communicated, those questions to me, or answers to me. And then in turn, I did my best to communicate that information for my readers. So, just pursuing the input of experts was probably 50% of the work for this book.
And prof, doctor, author, publisher, editor, all the different hats you've worn. Right now, a lot of your energy probably goes into being a publisher, I imagine, along with your mapping project and your gardening and running. So I don't want to abandon ice for the moment because I've got a snobbish question for you coming up about ice.
Love
I've just been writing about snobbery and I've become really interested in it.
Oh, I want to hear about that.
Yes, well, of course, this should really be about me and how important I am, but sadly, my alibi for getting to know you virtually is that it's not. But in all seriousness, so Orion Magazine is a remarkable thing, and I'm a very big fan. Could you do it can be longer than the elevator pitch, but could you tell people about it? And obviously, I'll include a link to it in the notes appended to this publication.
I would love to. So, Orion is a quarterly print magazine that's been around for more than 40 years. It was founded in 1982, and we're still going strong today. And we also have a digital edition of the magazine that is soon to be radically transformed. We're launching a new website and thus a new digital subscription in May. So that's really exciting. But at its heart, Orion is a magazine that explores the mysteries, the conundrums, the big questions about what connects humanity to our environments and all the other, living and non-living things that are included in those environments. We in recent issues we've explored, for example, water and the long history of humanity with water and how we used to understand better how water moved and why we need to let it do its thing and what the creation of things like dams and cities that ultimately covered up old rivers and old shorelines, how that kind of interfered with the kind of the natural motion of things, and also what it helped. I mean, that's the complicated truth about living in the Anthropocene, is that so much of what humanity does is for our benefit, but also has some devastating consequences. But we're not always so heady. We also recently published an issue dedicated to romance in the climate crisis and how climate change is affecting how people love and their relationships, what their dating practices are like. We are doing future issues coming out on film and how the climate crisis is captured or not in on TV, both and on the big screen. It's a wide range of things. We're always trying to strike that balance between cautionary tale and wonder for what the natural world is.
And could you explain to us what it means to be the publisher of a magazine as opposed to the editor, as opposed to the president, for example?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I should probably say my full title is, publisher and executive director. So, if there is, if there, we were going to say there's president of the magazine, I suppose, for better or for worse, that's me. Yeah, absolutely. Ultimately, my job is to make sure that all aspects of the publication are in concert and moving forward in a productive way. So, in other words, our editorial team stays on mission, but is also still feel like they have the freedom to be exploratory and daring. But that what they're doing is also aligned with our fundraising, because we're also a nonprofit. So we need to make
Right.
sure that those messages are aligned, that our marketing is still aligned, And at the end of the day, that our board of directors is also proud of what we're doing, and is helping us by being great advocates for the magazine. So I don't know, in a way I'm kind of a ringleader. Just making sure everything continues on a day-to-day basis the way that it should.
I like it. And before I get back to ice, I wanted to ask you about The World as We Knew It. A terrific volume that you helped put together. You were a dynamizing force for that.
Yes, I'm so proud of that book. I co-edited it with my good friend and colleague at large, Taja Eisen. And it's a collection of first-person essays about the writer's firsthand experiences with the climate crisis. When Taja and I reached out to writers to collaborate with us on this collection, our pitch to them was to think about how the climate crisis is affecting, their memories, their relationships, their lives, their own backyards. Because at the time, we started editing this collection as early as 2019. So, it's been a few years. At the time, there were very few essays that looked at the climate crisis at the level of a life. For the most part, writing about it was on this planetary scale, which makes sense because it's a planetary problem that affects entire communities. But it's more than that, right? It also affects us as individuals, and we wanted to have people writing about that, about their emotions, the impacts on their own psychologies. And I couldn't be prouder of how it came out. It's a wide range of essays with so many different, focal points and a lot of different tones. I think some of the essays, dare I say it, are even funny. I think it's a really good collection.
It is, and it also has a terrific introduction. In addition to adumbrating some of what is to follow, you guys have some poignant words of your own at the beginning.
Oh,
After
thank you.
the day after the Brexit vote that eventually sent Britain out of the European Union, the most played song on Spotify in the UK was "It's the End of the World as We Know It."
Oh, fitting.
Love it. And
Oh,
actually,
goodness.
Spotify advertised this immediately with huge banners all over London. But it's a fantastic book. I should say, ICE, my part in its downfall, as it were. No, your ICE book is brilliant. It is an absolute model of interdisciplinary work that is just beautifully put together. I'm a huge fanboy. So here's my snob question. In my trying to understand snobbery for something, I discovered that the two famous authors who've written about this are Thackeray, who wrote an entire book about it, and Virginia Woolf. And so what I learned was that the meaning seems to have changed quite dramatically. So with both Thackeray and Woolf, and Woolf's essay is a self-critical account, whereas Thackeray's is a sardonic witticism. The snob is the person who is a wannabe, who doesn't have cultural capital and wants to gain it by being around famous people. So Woolf talks about, I wanted to meet H.G. Wells. I wanted to meet Arnold Bennett. I wanted to be at their dinner parties because I was a snob. Whereas now it is thought of, as far as I can tell, more as I have cultural capital, you don't. And I wanted to ask you an ICE question about that, specifically related to putting ice in white wine. Because somehow or other, there's some evil part of me that grew up thinking that white wine should be served chilled, but adding ice to it, visibly or otherwise, was de trop. This was non-you. This should not happen. So tell me about the snobbish elements of using or not using ice in drinks is what I'm asking for, I guess.
No one has ever asked me this question before, and I love it so much because it just incorporates so many different ways of thinking about wine, yes, but also about ice, right? So for the record, let me put it out there. I don't like ice in my wine, my white wine. I do like it chilled, but I don't put ice in it, and I don't think I ever will. But so it's interesting. So if we go all the way back to Frederick Tudor, right? He almost certainly put ice in his wine. It was a fashion of the day. But then you might even say that that was the snobbish thing to do because not only did he have access to wine, but he also had access to ice. And the thing about early 19th century, America is that even people who lived in the northern states didn't necessarily have access to wine, excuse me, to ice in the summertime because they didn't have land if they weren't, unless they were wealthy. And you had to have land in order to have an ice house, which was this contraption in which ice was stored year round for use in the summertime. And so, in a way, putting ice in the white wine was not because he didn't have maybe the snobbish training, the cultural cachet, the cultural understanding of what good wine is, but because he actually had access to a commodity that most Americans did not. Now, whether people put ice in their wine today, you can get ice for a bag of ice for $2. So it's not so much a, that type of ice isn't necessarily a luxury thing. But what I think throws the wrench in this is that if you're putting ice in your wine made from one of those $400 countertop luxury ice machines, and then I don't know. I think all gloves are off at that point.
Wonderful. I wanted to ask you two more questions, if I may, and then throw it to you, lest there be things we haven't discussed you'd like to mention, or areas we have touched on where you want to add something. Does that sound okay as a means of concluding?
I love it.
Okay. So, of my last two questions, the first one is to ask you about Topeka, about which you've written, and in particular about poets in Topeka. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that, bearing in mind that 40% of listeners are in the US, which is the plurality, but obviously not the majority. And the rest are divided between Britain, Spain, Latin America, etc., etc., etc.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the 40, even for the 40% of your listeners who are in the United States, they may not know a thing about Topeka. Topeka is the capital of Kansas. It's also my hometown. And it is also the home of an astonishing number of poets,
Langston
which
Hughes, hello, who knew?
Langston Hughes lived there, Gwendolyn Brooks, Ben Lerner, goodness, I mean, just so many people, so many people, contemporary poets and historical poets alike. And this is astonishing to me because having grown up in the landlocked city of Topeka, Kansas, I never thought of it as being a cultural hotbed. Maybe this is my own snobbery coming out, but we weren't home to great theaters or libraries, although our local public library is pretty great, but people don't travel from elsewhere to visit it. we have a university there, but it's not well known, and yet so many poets come out of there. And my at the end of the day, I've written about a few different theories. One is that it was at one time the home of something called the Meninger Institute, which was a world-renowned hospital and research institution for mental health, and that attracted doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists from around the world to live in this tiny little Midwestern town, and they brought with them, a wealth of of education, experience, ideas that may not otherwise circulate in this fairly homogeneous town otherwise. So that's one theory. My other theory is that unlike many places now in the Midwest, Topeka has a fascinating political history. You know, Kansas was known as Bleeding Kansas because it was, a site of essentially a proxy war for the Civil War between the northern and southern states, and therefore had, was home to more what we might now call liberal ideas versus, more, old ideas of the old South, right? Kansas was one of the first states to, adopt socialist ideas in the early 20th century. We had schools that trained workers in socialist ideology. And today, both being a capital city, a place with a university, and a town with, a lot of people in an otherwise relatively unpopulated state. It also has a lot of more left-leaning and right-leaning leaning ideas circulating. And so here's my theory. This is a long way of saying that I think when you see these right-wing and left-wing, I'm being overly simplified here, but right-wing and left-wing ideas kind of butting heads, right? It creates a kind of tension that I think poets thrive in. A kind of tension that the best poets always infuse their work with, both in terms of the words, their format, their line breaks. And the result is that some pretty brilliant poets have come out of this town. I could also be full of hot water. I have no idea, but this is my thinking.
I love it. Thank you. And my last question, Dr. Amy, is to ask you, what were the things that you learned during the ICE project that most surprised you?
Wow. There's so many ways I can answer that. I mean, just the fact that ICE's history is so ephemeral, it might as well have been written on an ice cube, and just so much of it has melted away. In retrospect, it was a pretty difficult subject to write a whole book about because there's no such thing as a single ICE archive. Right. And so I had to do a lot of work to fill in those missing gaps. So that really surprised me. Something so ubiquitous has such a spotty history. The other thing, maybe in retrospect, I shouldn't have been surprised about was just the American reaction to mechanically made ice. The historical, the original natural ice trade, reached a high watermark around the 1860s, at which point mechanically made ice, ice made from machines and ice plants took over. But to get to that point, Americans had to overcome a lot of deeply ingrained Victorian era religious ideas about who has the right to create ice. The first time mechanical ice was made and made public, the man behind it, Dr. John Gorey, was vilified. There were actual headlines in actual newspapers that said there's a crank in Florida. He made ice in Florida for the first time. There's a crank down in Florida who thinks he can make ice as good as God Almighty. And I thought, wow, I always knew this nation had some puritanical origins, but that takes the cake.
It's wonderful. And finally, are there things you'd like to add to what we've already discussed?
Oh, thanks for the opportunity. I don't know what they would be, other than to say just thank you for the chance of talking with you today, and that I am going to be thinking about the role of snobbery, in I think in everything that I do now. That is a fascinating question of what snobbery is and how it's changed.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's been wonderful getting to know you a bit and learning so much from you. As I've said, your work is wonderful. but it was even better listening to you.
Oh, thanks so much, Toby. I had a lot of fun being here.